I think we've pointed out, or at least tried to point out, that James so often reflects the teaching of his half-brother Jesus, especially from the Sermon on the Mount, the teachings that are in this epistle have a background in what Jesus taught, and that's nowhere more obvious than what James has to say about the words that we say. And I put this up here just to illustrate to us that James has something to say about our words in each of the five chapters of this book. I think that in itself would be revealing, because he obviously means to say that that our faith has to be reflected first in our words. And just think through this with me for just a second. In the first place, James has had to say that we're to be swift to hear and slow to speak. All right, so that means I would say that our words, our speech has to be thought over, thought out first, and then controlled. And I say this from verse 26, where James has said that we need to bridle our tongues. That's the one of the first aspects of pure and undefiled religion. In chapter 2 and verse 12, we're to speak and to act as what?
Those who are judged by the law of liberty.
All right, we're to speak as people who are going to be judged by the law of liberty. So we must do our best to be accountable in our speech. In chapter 4 and verse 11, what does he have to say? With regard to words. Do what?
No slandering.
All right, no slandering. We don't speak evil against our brothers. So evil would be not only with regard to substance, but also of motives of this. No evil of our brothers, no slander, that type thing. And then chapter 5, verse 9, what? All right, this taking all the fun out of it, isn't it? No complaining, no, some of the versions use the word grumbling. No grumbling out of our mouths. And here in the biggest passage, obviously, in James, and also the biggest extended passage in the Bible about godly speech is in James 3, verses 1 through 12. And I'll mention to you that there are some scholars who believe that the entire section of James 2:14 through chapter 4:12 is really about speech. In other words, the faith and works idea is where somebody says he has faith and doesn't, his actions don't match it. So you think about that. Now, the main idea in chapter 3 in verses 1 through 12, if I were to try to summarize it, I think I would say it this way. When you speak, you try to realize the power, or to respect the power of your words. And boy, it's a lesson that we all try to learn all of our lives, I think, and never truly succeed at. But if you put all of that together, I want you to see what kind of an approach to speech that James is calling for here. And is there anything that Jesus taught that reminds you of? One thing about the Lord's teaching that jumps out to me almost immediately here with this. I give you a hint. It has to do with where words come from. All right, that's it. in Jesus, and both in Matthew 12 and in Matthew 15 and parallel passages taught that what defiles a man is what comes from his heart, from his innermost being, from his mind, in other words, and that's where words come from. And he said, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. That's the proverb that Jesus applied to speech is that one from Proverbs 4. So we have in James' teaching not only the Proverbs for life, but also the teachings of Jesus applied here, and especially with regard to our speech. James 3, verses 1 through 12 now becomes our focus here, and we could call it a laboratory for faith, for our faith, and that would be, I think, appropriate. Let's start in James 3 and verse 1. And there's a point made here to start with that needs to govern the rest of what we'll talk about this morning. James 3 and verse 1. Eddie, would you read, please, for us?
My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment.
All right. Now, at first thought, it seems that this whole passage is just about the responsibility of teaching, or of the teacher. And, of course, that is the launching place for this, but it's a place where the power of words is called forth most obviously. Not many of you should become teachers, he says here. Is he trying to discourage speaking in behalf of the gospel? Scott just led us in praying that we'd be able to talk about the joy that we have in Christ. So does James here mean to be discouraging people from saying anything about the Lord?
Well, some people may know the word, and some people may be like me. They can't tell it like it needs to be told.
All right. Does that mean the Lord doesn't want you to say anything about it?
No.
No, it doesn't.
But so, he doesn't want me to be a teacher.
All right. He may be calling attention to the fact that some are better than others, but he is dealing more here with motivation. If someone just wants to be heard and seen, or if someone just wants to be noticed, or if someone just wants the power or influence that he thinks he might have, then James would be discouraging that, certainly. That would be the wrong motive for teaching. The point that I want to call your attention to here is that James 3 and verse 1 at least reminds us of the need for us to be accountable for our words, but we don't want to suggest that James 3 and verse 1 discourages us from using the gift of speech to serve in the Lord's kingdom. I want you to consider for a moment some of the ways in which the blessing of speech or of our words is called for. How are we called upon to use that in the Lord's service? Well, one thing is teaching. How do I know that all of us at least have an obligation to aspire to doing what we can and teaching the Lord's Word? How about Hebrews chapter 5? For when by reason of time you ought to be teachers, you have need that somebody teach you again what are the first principles of God. So the at least for us to aspire to be able to speak in behalf of the Lord is there. And what else? What about the Great Commission? Yeah, I appreciate what Pat mentioned, and it's true that some are more cut out for that particular role in a public setting than others are, but all of us have a role to play in the fulfilling of the Great Commission. Think of some other ways. What I'm really getting at here is I can't read James 3 and say, well, my words are powerful, therefore I will just say nothing. Think of some other ways in which our word, in which we're called upon in Scripture to use the gift of speech. Larry?
Encouragement.
All right. One of the most important, the Scripture tells us to encourage one another. And, boy, we all know that we need that. In order for us to get it, what's going to have to happen? Somebody's going to have to say something. And that would be a really important thing. What else can you think of? All right. We're going to have to pray one for another, and prayer will involve speech. What else? All right, comfort. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 and following, where this is a special form of encouragement, I think. What else?
Correction.
All right, correction. Or sometimes to use the Bible word admonish. That would be there. What else?
Singing.
All right, praise. Can I use that word, Larry? Singing, in which we teach and admonish. All right, what else?
Showing mercy.
All right, words of mercy. Can I use the idea of forgiveness along with that here? What about this one? Joy or congratulations. That's appreciation or how about this? Thanksgiving. And what about, I'm going to quit here because what about just life? I mean, the speech in a lot of ways is the things life is made of. Think of the Proverbs. Again, and a word fitly spoken, which I think means a word spoken in just the right time and the right way, is like apples of gold in a network of silver. It's like an engraving, if you could imagine that. That would be the power of words. So we may not say, use James 3 to be like a turtle who draws his head back in the shell and says, I will make sure that I do not make a mistake in what I say. I will therefore say nothing. You can't do that and live as a Christian. Chatty?
Well, thought that it was telling me not to teach, but if you're going to teach, know that what you're saying is going to have some effect on some person's soul, maybe.
Maybe, yes. Be aware of that. We'll
be not responsible for their soul, but you could turn it away too, maybe.
Okay. Let me come back to that in just a second here. I want to ask Brennan if you would turn over to Ephesians chapter 4, and let's just sum up this statement we're trying to make here from Ephesians 4. And verse 29, please. Everybody think about this.
Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear.
All right, look at the three. God, of course, no corrupting talk, but the talk that's good for building up. And that kind of talk fits the occasion, and it gives grace to people who hear. That kind of speech we're obligated to involve ourselves in our families, in a congregation, in our daily interaction with our neighbors. Now let's go back to James 3 for a second and think about what Chatty just said. This is the point that James is making about teaching in James chapter 3 and verse 1. And that is that someone who accepts a role of special responsibility is going to be held to greater accountability. James 3 verse 1 says, "For you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness." That is a very sobering thought. Let me ask you this. Does it just mean those who teach a class or teach from the pulpit? See, in other words, this has a wider application than maybe we think at first. I'm going to look at Luke 12 and verse 48 for us. Luke 12 and verse 48. And this would be an example maybe of this principle that greater responsibility means greater accountability. Verse 48, especially the last part of the verse, Linda, would you read that? You have it, Luke 12, 48.
"But the one who does not know and those things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. For from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked."
All right, there's the last part of that verse is the thought we're getting at. If someone desires to have a role, a life teaching, if he's entrusted with much opportunity, then he's judged more strictly. That becomes the backdrop for what James wants to say about words in this passage. And let's kind of outline it this way if we can. The first is that one who speaks in the sense of teaching, when someone undertakes to speak, is I'll put it this way, has a greater responsibility or accountability. You understand what we're getting at from that. Now, that's 3:1. Now, why is that? Look at chapter 3 and verse 2. This begins to lay down the rest of the story for us. James 3, verse 2. Scott?
"For we all stumble in many ways, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle his whole body."
All right. Ain't it the truth? Why is James 3 and verse 2 true in your experience? "For we all stumble in many ways." How do you learn that? From stumbling, all right? The Bible teaches that we all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. It teaches if any of us say we have no sin, we do what? We deceive ourselves. We make ourselves into liars. But if anybody says that he doesn't stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. All right, and able to bridle his whole body. I take that to mean that the tongue is harder to bridle than anything else. Why is that? Y'all learned this lesson so well, you're not even going to say anything, are you?
It's so easy to say something that you don't actually mean, or it comes out in a different way than you want it to.
All right. It comes out because in our words, it's so easy for it to come out wrong and for the person who hears it to take a message from it other than the one you meant to convey. All right? Don't we all know that? All right. Can you go farther? Why else is this true?
It reveals the heart, and sometimes our heart isn't exactly what you want it to be.
All right. Sometimes it comes out either in a tone that expresses the emotions that we're dealing with, or we say things before we have the chance to taste the words and think them over. That happens sometimes. Can you think of anything else? Sometimes we're just mistaken in what we say. Our information is inadequate and so on. Think back to that first list that I had from each one of these chapters, and let's use that as kind of an outline in why it is that if someone doesn't stumble in what he says, he's perfect. Remember, chapter 1, verse 19 had to do with words spoken too quickly. Verse 26, words spoken in an uncontrolled way. Chapter 2, verse 12, words spoken that don't fit with the law of liberty in the sense that they show no mercy, unmerciful words. Chapter 4 and verse 11, words that do someone else harm or are slanderous words. And chapter 5 and verse 9, words that are characterized by murmuring and complaining. Poor me, in other words. Each of those areas, if you think about it, is a way in which we may stumble in what we say. So here, if you put these two ideas together, a man who speaks will be judged with greater strictness, and we're more likely to stumble in what we say than we are anywhere else. Then you begin to see what James is getting at. Words, we stumble here more than anywhere else. Everybody has known the exasperation of having said something you wish you could take back, or having said something that communicated a poor message, or having said something that you didn't really mean. Everybody has had that happen. And yet, the value of our words from the things that we mentioned before are such that saying nothing is not an option. So the question is, how do we go about this? Well, the next section here, verses 3 through 5, shows the power of small things. Words are an example where the power of small things is obvious. And he uses three illustrations here. Now let's look at them quickly here. Verse 3 through 5, Todd, read for us if you don't mind.
When we put bits into the mouths of horses, we make them obey us. We can turn the whole animal, or take ships as example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder, wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark.
All right, now think about what he's saying here. The three illustrations are, if you think about them, first a bit in a horse's mouth. Everybody in here knows what a bit is. You can put that bit in that powerful animal's mouth and then use the bridle, the reins, to turn the whole body. And that would indicate strength under control. I wish we could do that with our tongues all the time. I wish I could with mine. The second illustration is a rudder on a great ship. The rudder being a little flap at the back of the bottom of the boat, and the person at the helm can turn that whole great ship just by the use of that rudder, so that it moves the boat and places the boat under control of the one who is piloting it. And it can even be so when that boat is driven by strong winds, or when, in our case, a powerful engine might be running it, that rudder still makes the difference. And then a small spark of fire may have such a powerful influence that a great forest can be set ablaze by it. Thinking about the power of small things, how many of you in here can remember something that was said to you, for good or bad, when you were a child? For most of us in here, that's been a while back. For some of us more than others. How many of you can remember something that was said specifically to you when you were a small child? I can. I could tell you both one that set positive things to happening in my life, and ones that made me feel about that tall, things that were said. I've seen families ruined by words. I've seen congregations struggle over some little bitty thing that somebody said. I've seen people have their lives struck by the things, little things they say to themselves, even. And James' point is that the reason that he wants people to think it over before they talk is that they'll be held to stricter standards, that this is an area where we all are human, and the human tendency is to say things that we either regret or that we wish we could take back, and that a word is a powerful thing. Noah, can you finish this song or this poem? Sticks and stones may.
No, but words can never harm me.
Is that true?
No.
Oh, we said it like we wished it were true, but we still remember the words, don't we? We remember the names we got called when we were in grade school, most of us. And boy, that's an important lesson. Now, using the last thing that Todd read there about the forest being set ablaze by a fire, James turns from the how powerful a small thing can be to next, what great damage can be done by words, and this is really just the application of the previous thought, but it's still important. And he uses the three illustrations again to make this point. So let's read verse 5 again, and then read all the way down through 12 this time for us. Who'd like to read that I haven't called on? I might be overlooking somebody to get. Somebody want to read here? Okay, Lance.
Such as the tongue is a small part of the body, yet it has great potential. Think how small a flame sets a huge forest ablaze. When the tongue is a fire, the tongue represents the word, the world of wrongdoing among the parts of our bodies, leads the entire body and sets fire to the source of human existence and sets fire by hell. For every kind of animal, bird, reptile, and sea creature is subdued and can be subdued by humankind, but no human can subdue the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse the people made in God's image. From the same mouth come blessings and cursing. These things should not be so, my brothers and sisters. A spring does not pour out fresh water and dirty water from the same ocean, does it? Can a fig tree produce olives, brothers and sisters, or a vine produce fig? Neither can salt water spring produce fresh bark.
All right. Now, I want to work through that reading in two or three different thoughts in mind. The first one on what great damage can be done by speech. Obviously, the first illustration is a fire in the forest. What does that do? Have any of you ever had the experience of going on vacation or on a drive somewhere, going through one of the great national parks, and you were so looking forward to looking at the forest along the way there, and you got by a place where a forest fire had occurred? It's kind of a disappointment, isn't it? How many lives are like that? Where the destructive process has been set in order by words. Notice that in verse 8, what illustration is used here? Instead of a fire, which is destructive, what is it here?
Poison.
All right, poison. All right, and the poison, of course, is a deadly influence or deadly thing in someone's life. And then in verse 11 and 12, you take the idea of a spring or a well of water. How much bad stuff in the water does it take? How many parts per million of coliform do you want in your water? Scott has to figure that kind of stuff out sometimes in his work. My point is that words, even if they don't completely destroy, can dilute happiness to such a degree, or healthiness to such a degree, that it robs life of what it is meant to be and what it should have. Now, look at verses 6 and following, and look at the sort of the idea of the course that started, or the cycle that started here. The tongue is a fire which is like a world of unrighteousness. And look at what he says it can do. The words, I'm going to put it up here like this. Words begin a cycle of things in life that it's hard to control and hard to turn around. It's set among the members, he says, in such a way that it stains the whole body. This is the principle of being members of the body in reverse. When your tongue says the wrong thing, how much of your body is affected by it? Of course, the whole you, the whole body is. It says that the tongue can set on fire the entire course of life. I want you to think of families for a moment, and how families, I heard that bell, you'll want to know that, and how families either work through conflict or how families communicate. Suppose I grow up in a family where every single little dissatisfaction in daily life is dealt with at the top of our voices, with angry, belittling, attacking words. Then when I get in my own family, as time goes along, and I'm raising them, and in the moments when I'm just dealing with life in ways where I don't stop and think it over first, how am I likely to deal with conflict and frustration? Very same way. The same attacking, belittling, angry, loud tones. The tongue sets on fire the entire course of life. And look at this. James says it is set on fire by hell. I think he just means by that, if it's this fiery course, who strikes the match, lights the fuse?
Satan.
All right, Satan, the evil one, which, by the way, we mentioned slander or whatever. Whose name means slanderer? All right. Satan. What's at the root of his being. Look just real quickly at verses 7 and following here. The tongue, he says, no man can tame. Is there any place where it's more obvious that we need the Lord's help than in this one? And if it can't be tamed, is there any place where we can, is there anything that can interrupt this cycle that we're talking about here that's set on fire? It has to be forgiveness, doesn't it? At some point, forgiveness of I can't gather up my words, but many times I've had to ask the Lord to forgive me for them. And I think I'm not a unique human being in that way. Probably all of us understand that idea. And verses 9 and 10, notice that consistency is called for. How? How is consistency called for here? I want to write consistency is the jewel when it comes to words. But look at what I'm getting at. If I bless the Lord, what should I do with people, with my words? Curse them? No, I ought to bless them too. Why? Well, they're made in His image, and my life needs to be consistent with what I've said to God on the Lord's Day. This is why some people believe this section belongs with the previous one about faith and works. What I say about my faith needs to be shown in my works. What I say to God in my words needs to be reflected in what I say to people in my daily life. And then, from the same mouth, verse 10, comes forth what? Blessing and cursing. Should that be so? No, it's inconsistent. You can't have, if all words come from your heart first, then they shouldn't be characterized by both blessing and cursing. Now, that's the ideal that we strive for. We've already found out that none of us achieves that perfectly. But what we're after is for our words to be consistent with our highest ideals and what we really think of God. That's what we're after and what we shoot for. Now, that means that we have homework this week, all of us. So that would be something to work on, wouldn't it? For all of us to try to make sure our words are consistent with what we're about to do in a few minutes here together as a church. Let's be a blessing with what we say this week. Thank you guys for being with us.